There's probably a little bit too much fuss made about scores.
I think I'm a farmer deep down at heart. I wanted a family endeavor.
It's not about what someone else says. It's not about what rating it got. It's about what you enjoy drinking.
Wine to start with is something that is social.
It's about networking. It's about calling up people and ask for advice. And everybody's willing to help out.
Consumer wants something that's uncomplicated about wine. Why do you want one more thing to worry about?
I would trade this for nothing. It is my life and it is my dream.
You know, you only get to make one wine a year. It's not very much. I've been making wine most of my adult life, you know. It's only 35 Cabernets. I don't think that's a lot. I'm up for more.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle and welcome to podcast number 63. In this program, we talk to Will Allen, CEO of Growing Power. Cheers.
First things first, Will Allen is not a vintner. Will Allen is a farmer and, in fact, an urban farmer. Will is president of Growing Power, a company dedicated to urban farming, headquartered in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. His book, The Good Food Revolution, talks about the need for growing local food, as in the farm-to-table concept, an idea commonly found in wine country. One of Will's yet-to-be-realized ambitions is to grow grapes in a hoop house, similar style to a greenhouse. And more than likely, he'll make it happen. Will visited our studios in May of 2012 to talk about his style of farming. I'm here with the founder and CEO of Growing Power, Will Allen. How are you doing, Will?
Oh, I'm doing great.
Thanks very much for being here today. So I know a lot of our listeners are going to be going, well, hey, this guy's a farmer. We're not talking about wine, but gee, Will, where does wine come from? But a farm, right?
Right, exactly. Folks that are growing grapes are farmers. I mean, every aspect, it's all about the soil and understanding and getting the experience to be able to produce a great product. You know, I don't know a lot about growing grapes, but it's something that I think should be part of the sustainable movement to be able to grow grapes, either for eating or growing organic wines. And I think that's really important.
And just before we started the interview, we were talking about the idea of some of these wineries that are biodynamic and sustainable. And your big focus is eliminating chemicals as much as possible or 100%. Is that your goal?
Well, we don't use any chemicals. We compost. This year we'll compost 40 million pounds of food and carbon residue into very fertile compost that we grow everything in, because the soil, especially inside of cities where we have a lot of our production, is contaminated with arsenic, and we're in a heavy lead city, as most of the Midwestern industrial cities are. So it's important to grow new soil. And as I was telling you earlier, in Cleveland, there's a wine orchard right in the middle of the city of Cleveland. So we're seeing a lot of these, call them micro projects all over the country. And so this is part of the food system that we're growing. And that's why we call it the Good Food Revolution, because so many different folks want to get involved on many different levels. So we can't just say we're just growing vegetables. We can grow grapes locally and create jobs and so forth.
So I guess the first thing I want to do here is talk about Growing Power. So let our audience know exactly what is Growing Power.
Well, Growing Power is a not-for-profit organization that really started about 16 years ago. I bought the last remaining farm in 1993, and I bought it for selfish reasons, to sell my farm produce. I was farming about 100 acres outside of the city. I was looking for a place to sell my produce, and I came across, as I was at the time working for Procter & Gamble in sales and sales technology, and I was driving down the street, and this place was for sale, and I found out it was the last remaining farm. It was owned by the city. The city of Milwaukee had repossessed it from the previous owner, and I thought it would be a great place for me to market my produce. And along a continuum, it's grown from first couple of years running as a for-profit. A couple of years later, I worked with some youth, and my friends said, you should start a nonprofit. And here we are today with an organization that has 110 employees. We have 20 farms now. We have 15 regional training centers around the U.S., and we're growing food and really trying to change the dynamics of how people source their food locally. We're trying to quantify a lot of things in terms of aquaculture. We raise fish, over 100,000 lake perch and tilapia at our facility, and we train over 1,000 farmers a year in a number of different areas, from beekeepers to growing food inside greenhouses so we can have year-round production, to growing sprouts and building greenhouses. We hope to have over 100 acres of greenhouses in and around Milwaukee to change the dynamics of being able to get more local food, because right now less than 1% of our food is local. So we want to move that in the next several years to about 10%, which will create thousands of jobs and keep millions of dollars in our local economy.
So are majority or are all of these farms urban?
We have some right on the outskirts of Milwaukee, but the majority of them are inside the city. The city of Milwaukee has a lot of vacant land, and we're able to get some of that land. We're also a land trust, so we're trying to put that land in long-term agricultural use, either by purchasing it or getting really, really long leases on that land, because we have to totally change the dynamics of the soil by growing using compost. And we grow on asphalt, concrete, on rooftops, in some of the most unlikely places. We actually have a greenhouse that was used to grow cemetery flowers at one of the largest cemeteries here, Forest Home, where all the founders of Milwaukee are buried, and mayors and so forth. So we're using those greenhouses now to grow food.
And as I recall, when I first met you, the one thing we chatted about was your preference is to be able to do all greenhouse farming, because you're able to do it year-round, right?
Yeah, it's very difficult to grow food outside because of changing climate conditions. You can't really predict what's going to happen. You can lose your crop to hail. You can lose your crop to viruses, tomato viruses. But inside a controlled environment, and these hoop houses are very inexpensive if you're able to grow, build them from scratch, and that's what we do. Build those hoop houses from straight pipe, bending it, and putting up these hoop houses wherever we can find space.
So is that more like a visqueen rather than glass on top of those?
Yeah, we use 6 mil plastic, greenhouse plastic, and you can find these at old factories. You can find these on the exterior of almost any site. When I look at a farm, I don't look at a farm the way other people look at a potential farm. I look at a space, and if it's concrete or asphalt, that's fine. If it's hard pan clay, that's fine, because we have no digging equipment. We don't dig down. We put 2 feet of new soil to be able to grow our crops. And you can almost grow anything. You can grow trees in that kind of situation. So I think you and I were talking about grapevines, and you really spurred my interest. Now I want to at least do a test plot this year and get some grapevines and learn how to do it.
If you do, let me know. I'd love to come out and take some pictures and see what you're doing. Obviously, vines take a long time to root and grow, but you got my interest going because I've thought in the past you couldn't do grapevines because they're so long. But with this hoop house you're talking about,
right,
the sky's the limit. You could move that anytime you want, really, right? I mean,
right. And, you know, I ran across a farm in Minnesota that's 60 acres. And they're growing everything. They actually have apple trees inside hoop houses. They're growing strawberries and raspberries and just the most unlikely things. In our greenhouses, because we heat them with a thermal mass of hot water, it creates a tropical environment. So we've been able to demonstrate you can grow bananas and sugar cane and avocados and figs and almost any kind of fruit. So in the future, we can start growing fruit inside these high tunnels because, again, it's cost effective because of the fact that we build them from scratch.
And it doesn't necessarily have to be anything that would be indigenous. This could be something that could have been grown, say, in South America or anywhere else, right?
Absolutely. So urban agriculture, growing food close to where people live really makes sense because of the economics and the fact that if you're able to cut the production cost, because that's what it's all about in terms of price. When we ship food from far away, especially with the trucking and the high cost of fossil fuel, our prices of fruits and vegetables have gone sky high. The cost of a truck that you used to be able to get a truck, I remember years ago, for about $2,000 from California. Now it costs $6,000-$7,000 to get a 53-foot semi across the nation.
And you made the point last time that, you know, because of that travel time, you're not having, it's not fresh, whatever you're getting, versus having something local.
Right. Whenever you ship something, it changes environment several times. And because it takes about 3 days to get it, and sometimes it sits out there in warehouses for a couple of days, and it comes here and it's put in warehouses, and then it goes out on a grocery store shelf, and we get it, and do we eat it right away? Sometimes not. We put it in our refrigerator, and sometimes it's 10 days old, and it's lost 50% of its nutrient value, a lot of crops, and we have no way of measuring that. So even if we pay a lot of food, go to a high-end store, it doesn't mean you're eating food that's going to keep you healthy and happy.
You make a good point, though, that you can't measure that. You can eyeball it, you can feel it, you can squeeze the melon, you can do whatever you want, but it doesn't talk. It's not going to tell you how old it is and what it's got left in it.
Right, and if you go into a retail store, grocery store, and ask somebody, how old is this, these vegetables or this meat or whatever, you know, they might have a sell-by date on it, but they can't really tell you very much about the food that you're getting. So we're kind of in the blind, and we have to kind of trust, and, you know, when you trust, look what we've problems we've had with all the food scares and the fact that the USDA really have a very poor method of tracking down where these problems originate because they don't have enough people.
Many winemakers have said to me, a couple of vineyard managers have said to me, when they talk to people about being a farmer, they'll always ask them the question, where do your groceries come from? And right. Of course, the average answer for most people are going to be, well, the grocery store, and they go... Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
There are people like you.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know very much about our food, and more people are asking the question today, and that's why urban agriculture growing around the edges of cities, small farms are resurrecting now, and more young people getting involved. About 75% of folks that want to do this are under 40 years of age now, which is a huge change and really an important change. So we can start building a system that really works because the current system has led us to diabetes rates. I don't know if you've seen the latest statistics. By 2030, they say that 42% of us will be obese in America unless we change our ways. So it's a tremendous opportunity for us to change the food system, but it's going to have to be done by communities. We're going to have to be proactive and learn how to farm because farming is something to be respected like it is in Europe and Israel and other places I've been around the world. It's a very skilled kind of profession. It's an art form that people have to learn. You can't learn it overnight. You never stop learning about how to farm. All it takes is a little bug like it happened years ago in the soil in Napa and Sonoma that kill a lot of vines and a bug in the ground, and you have to figure out ways of getting rid of that to move forward. You know, you're always learning. You can't get too confident or cocky. Farming will keep you very grounded and very modest.
Yeah, Mother Nature doesn't screw around, right?
That's right.
You were referring to phylloxera, right? The problems they've had, obviously, in California in the past and the clever ways they've been able to work around this by the rootstock they use and then the whole idea of different clones. It's a fascinating business. Any winemaker is going to tell you, and everybody out there has already said this in their heads while they listen, great wine is made in the vineyard.
Yes, and that's what it's all about. And it really is. Those folks are very passionate. All these farmers that are doing sustainable agriculture is a very passion-driven occupation. But we want people to be able to make a living. So we're starting to quantify a lot of things that will help young people want to become farmers. And they won't come from rural America. They'll come from the universities and the nonprofits that are working in community gardens and community programs. That's where our next set of farmers will come. But we have to pass on things that we've learned so far to this next generation, and I believe they'll take it and really run with it and change the dynamics of how we get our food.
I imagine you get a lot of energy working with young people, being able to show them these things that they've never even dreamed of, and especially when you're able to do it in the city, because nobody thinks of that, do they?
Right. I think these young people just blow me away with their interest and their desire to want to be a part of it because it breaks down all of those myths that people sit on the outside and about folks that are in the inner city. They don't want to, they're lazy or whatever. That's totally not true. And folks, if you give folks an opportunity, especially for jobs, you know, and that's what it's all about, is to really create jobs. All of these cities around the country, the politicos want to have sustainable green cities by 2020. Unless we have a sustainable food system, that'll never happen. So I think this will present tremendous opportunity for folks, regardless of what crop you grow. And like I said, I'm very interested because if we can grow grapes inside cities on small, get enough people doing that, just like we're doing in the rural communities around Wisconsin, all of that is really good.
It occurred to me, thinking about the whole idea of grapes, you know, one of the limitations we've had here, of course, for growing certain kinds of varietals is the weather. You know, we don't have the most pleasant weather in the world here.
One of the things, and maybe you and I can work on this, is to try do some research and try to grow some inside hoop houses, climate-controlled greenhouses that we're constructing. So you're able to grow apple trees, all different types of fruit in there. We've created an environment. We can grow bananas and avocados and sugar cane. So we can create these environments in a natural kind of way using soil that we grow. So that's something that we need to continue to do our research. And the only way to do it is try it. Mm-hmm. And tweak it, you know, and that's how we've done everything in the development of our organization and development of urban agriculture around the country.
I'm sure you know all 50 states grow grapes now. All 50 states have wineries. It's growing, and it's going to continue to grow. This, you could be really onto something here, especially in parts of the country that have the kind of weather we have.
Yeah, remember when they said you couldn't grow grapes in this state and that state? Now, the statement you just made, that we're growing grapes in all 50 states because people found varieties and cultivars that actually work.
Exactly.
And different climates and different soil conditions and so forth. So
yeah.
Anything is possible when it comes to agriculture or almost anything.
Well, especially the approach you're taking because it's unique and it's greenhouse, so you're much more controlled. I wanted to ask you, since you talked about fish, which we got into last time, which was really interesting to hear, have you headed towards anything, beef, otherwise? Is that in your future?
Well, one of the things that we're doing is, of course, in the city of Milwaukee, now residents can have chickens, layers, no roosters, of course. And bees, honey production is much better inside cities because of all the flora in cities and because of the way we farm in our rural communities using Roundup Ready GMO crops and we've gotten rid of all the weeds that produce the pollen. So we get about 50% more production in urban America doing honey production. So there's some tremendous opportunities for different types of animals and, of course, worms, to be able to grow worms and create fertilizer by feeding them the food waste that normally would go into landfills and create this organic fertilizer that we need. And we produce about 100,000 pounds of worm castings every 4 months. So that's an opportunity for jobs and create jobs and create the interest. And we're finding universities are starting to have degree programs in sustainable agriculture and green technology around agriculture to reduce the cost by using renewable energy, which we use. We wouldn't be able to cash flow some of our stuff without renewable energy that we use today.
The worm thing fascinates me, the amount of worm castings and how much, what is the weight? What is it you have in worms right now?
Well, we started out with 30 pounds of worms about 16 years ago through a small youth project that wasn't going so well. And I said, you know, I don't like doing worms in plastic containers. So I started building these boxes and studied it for about 5 years. And, you know, when you do something for a long time, all of a sudden a light will go on. And you say, you know, I almost got this, you know. And that's when I went out and started training people in the way that I do it, which is totally different than what you'll find in a book in terms of putting worms in compost and having them break the compost down into worm castings, which cuts down the time that it takes to produce worm castings. And now we're up to, on just one farm, we've got more than this, but 7,000 pounds of worms from 30 pounds of worms. So it's a large part of what we do. And of course, worms are essential in terms of sustainable organic production.
That's a heck of a family. Wow.
And a lot of employees. We've got a few billion employees, you know.
Oh, yeah, you're not kidding. I don't want to be there when they come to collect their checks. So let's talk about the book. The title of the book is The Good Food Revolution. And it is exactly that. I mean, everything you've been saying is just that. It is revolutionary. You're trying to wake more people up. You're trying to wake up the establishment as it is, but you're also trying to get the youth involved, which is you do a lot of training. But tell me a little bit about the book.
Yeah, The Good Food Revolution is really about a journey that starts with my family from South Carolina. My parents were sharecroppers that moved to the Washington, D.C. area. So it's about the legacy of our family. They've been in farming for over 400 years. the movement started really strong around the 60s with folks dropping out and going out into rural areas, and it moved along a continuum where academics started studying the food system and crusty old farmers like me were involved. And now it's gone to a stage where, like I said before, young people under 40 years of age want to do this act. They don't know how to do it, but they want to do it. The excitement's there. The opportunity is there, and Milwaukee has taken the leadership role. That's why they call Milwaukee the urban egg capital of the world. And we're building infrastructure and really quantifying a lot of things because folks need to know, how do I make money doing this? Can I make a living wage? And that's what we really need to quantify. We really need to change many of the policies that cities have against growing food and composting inside cities. So that's what we're doing. And the book really has a historical perspective about how African-American folks, who comprised around 900,000 farms, now down to 18,000 farmers. So that's been a big drop, and less than 1% of the farmers are African-American today. So the resurrection has started with, I think, a lot of help from the First Lady, who I've worked with on the Let's Move campaign. And the garden on the White House lawn has led to 10 million new people wanting to grow food. And many of those are people of color that are living in food deserts that desperately need food to change the health dynamic of those communities. The book really talks about a lot of those issues and the future of vertical farms to be able to grow food in the air. In vertical farms, and we're going to build the first one in the world at our national, international headquarters here in Milwaukee.
Hmm. What's a vertical farm? I mean, I'm not. I get it in my head, but I'm not quite
right.
Clear.
It's a building that you can grow on multiple levels. There have been renderings that you can feed 50,000 people on 50-story vertical farm in New York City or Tokyo or Vancouver, these cities that don't have a large land mass inside the city. So it's going to be necessary in the future because what's happening around the world is more people are moving into cities. Actually, now we have more people living in and around cities around the world than in rural areas because of the harsh conditions in rural areas around the world. So we have to feed millions more people, and it's really about our basic survival in terms of it's not sustainable anymore to continue to breed unhealthy people. Hospitals are really struggling financially, especially the inner city hospitals. So we're starting to hear from doctors and hospitals that want to get involved in integrative medicine to connect with the community, to do preventative medicine. So they're kind of all over. And even insurance companies, now that we have the reforms, they want to get involved in trying to keep people healthy.
What you're doing is fantastic. And the best part of it is it's just all common sense, isn't it?
Yeah, it's basically common sense and things that we've done in the past, because we used to have local food systems. We used to grow the food inside the states where we live. But now that we have this crazy system of shipping food and saying that we can feed the world, well, we've never been more hungry than we are today. The world, tonight, one out of six young people in America will go to bed without a meal. So in a country that has so many riches, that shouldn't be.
It's a startling statistic, and it's something that people need to really pay attention to. Are there other people around the country doing what you're, other than who you've educated, are there satellites of what you're doing, or are there other people like yourself? Are there other Will Allens around the country with this same attitude, wanting to build this same industry?
Well, we're hoping, because of our regional training centers, we're hoping to breed. There are thousands of youth programs and thousands of schools now that are working with young people and have school gardens, and universities have school gardens. So we're in the infancy stages of really building this, and we want to prove, we want to quantify that you can scale this up to a meaningful place. And like I said, if we can get 100 acres of greenhouses in Milwaukee, we're going to change and grow food year-round in a climate. If we can do it here, you can do it almost anywhere in the world.
Yeah, especially with our climate here, because it's one of the most unpredictable places you could ever imagine to live in terms of.
Right, right. So that's what's exciting about this, because it's you have to be creative, innovative, and that's what these young people have great confidence in this next generation. And I did a commencement speech at my alma mater, University of Miami, a few days ago, last weekend. And I'll be doing a commencement speech at UW-Milwaukee in a few days. And these young people that come and volunteer, They're very interested in doing something different, to giving back to the community, because they understand that they want to eat better, they want to have opportunities, and they want to be a part of the community. And they don't necessarily want to go and work for these corporate companies like their parents, because they've seen their parents suffer and losing their jobs and so forth. So I have a lot of confidence in this next generation.
And you're out doing a lot of traveling promoting the book, which I assume the book is available in your local bookstore.
Yes, it's available online, of course, and we're off to a great start in terms of book sales. And it's a book that can be used by high school, college students. It's easy to read. It gives a lot of historical data. So a lot of schools, I did a book signing last night in Naperville, Illinois, and a university there bought 500 copies. So,
oh, nice.
So, and we have another university about 750 copies even before the book was date, which started May 10th. So we're off to a great start. I hope folks enjoy the book and they can get something out of it as we build the Good Food Revolution.
And where can our listeners learn about the Good Food Revolution online if they want to learn about Will Allen?
Well, we have a website, growingpower.org. That's a place, and we have trainings throughout the year, national, international trainings. We'll have probably the largest conference in the world around sustainable food this September at State Fair Park at the Expo Center. Be over 3,000 people, 17 different tracks that include every business you could think of, from political to education to renewable energy. We have planning track. So that's where people come together and get their energy to be able to go out and build this revolution.
And that's here in Milwaukee?
That'll be here at State Fair Park.
When is that?
September 7th, 8th, and 9th.
Excellent. That's good for people to know. And they could come meet you there, and they could learn more about this whole process.
Yeah, we'll have some of the innovators from all over the world there doing breakout sessions and plenaries and keynote addresses at the conference.
Well, I really appreciate you coming back to the studio again to do this interview. I appreciate you taking the time. I know you're busy and you're on the road quite often, but thank you for being here, but thank you for what you do, because it's inspiring, and I hope we're able to follow up on this whole idea of vineyards.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it, because now you really piqued my I like Concord grapes, and to grow them and see them growing in the city would be really fantastic.
And it'd be something nobody's, to the best of my knowledge, has done.
Right, right, exactly.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Learn more about Growing Power and Will Allen at growingpower.org.
Thanks for listening to this program. Watch for our next podcast featuring Doug Schaefer of Schaefer Vineyards in Napa Valley. Remember to watch for photos and updates on our Life Between the Vines Facebook page. Cheers.
Life Between the Vines was produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Assistant editor, Bob Warner. Original music by Tim Turton. Web design by Jenny Holland. Our web geek is Tim Panicucci. Photos by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2012.